Welcome back to the Real Life Theology Podcast. Today we launch a brand new series on the disciples' mind. In today's episode, Chad Ragsdale, who is the academic dean at Ozark, and Daniel McCoy, the editorial director for New.org, explore the importance of critical thinking and a biblical worldview for Christians navigating today's complex cultural challenges. Now, this was taken straight from an event at Ozark Christian College, and I'm honored to get to share it with you today. Let's check out what they have to say.
So I'll introduce myself first. My name's Chad Ragsdale. I am serving as the academic dean here at Ozark, and I've been here since 2005 in various roles, various capacities. For years, I taught mostly in the Bible area of the curriculum. These last several years now, I've been teaching more in like the philosophy and apologetics part of our curriculum. And then, like I said, this is, I think, year three for me serving as academic dean, which is a lot of fun. We love being here, wouldn't want to be anywhere else. We're excited about the things that God is doing on this campus and through this campus, and excited about some new initiatives that we're working on, including publishing, which is kind of the topic and the theme of this session today. One of the things that we see Ozark doing, and one of the things that we want to continue to do, is to resource the church. And that comes in various different forms. It could come in the form of a podcast. It could come in the form of, you know, some of our video resources. But we also want to resource the church in the written word as well. And so hopefully over the next several years, there will be a whole host of books written by Ozark faculty, especially books on, you know, the understanding of Scripture. And so we've been blessed at Ozark to also partner with Renew.org in various ways, in various capacities. One of the ways that we've partnered with Renew is in publishing. And that's kind of the topic for this session. Daniel, why don't you introduce yourself?
Yeah, thanks for coming, everybody. My name is Daniel McCoy. I live in the Cedar Rapids, Iowa area. I'm the editorial director for Renew.org. We renew the teachings of Jesus to fuel disciple-making. One of the things we do is it's like we take the people from the theology table and the people from the disciple-making table, bring them together to the same table and create resources. So it's a lot of fun, but that's my full-time job. And then I'm also I'm philosophy professor at large here at Ozark. I love to be a part of Ozark and the great things that are being done here. So, yeah, I think that's...
Daniel wears a lot of hats.
I have kids too. Lots of kids.
I have three kids. My kids are older than Daniel's kids, but I've got three teenagers, one of whom is a freshman here at Ozark this year, which has kind of blown me away. How old are your kids?
5 to 15, three girls and two boys in that order.
Wow. So, yeah, Daniel wears a lot of hats, like he said, teaches for us, works for Renew, has written several books now. How many books have you?
This will be number 9, I think.
Yeah. So pretty prolific author, too. Go to renew.org to check out all those resources, right? Yeah. So what we wanted to talk about this afternoon is Daniel and I have launched a new book this week called The Disciple's Mind. And we wanted to dedicate this time slot to just discussing a few of the ideas, a few of the key principles that you would find in that book. So we wanted to start out by just introducing you to the book. What is it about? What need is it trying to meet? Those sorts of questions. And I guess I'll start with the need first. Why a book like this is necessary. We live in a world, as you are well aware, we live in a world just chock full of all sorts of competing ideas, competing truths. Truths that are competing to have us build our lives upon, right? And to be a disciple in this world requires that we learn to think soberly, we learn to think biblically, we learn to think critically as we are living our lives in this world. Teaching philosophy here at Ozark and just teaching just in general here at Ozark through the years, I love our students. Our students are amazing. I just can't say enough good about our students. But one of the things that I do find deeply troubling is the extent to which even my own students fall captive to some of the false ways of thinking that exist in the world. And so I can't speak for Daniel's motivation. I can speak for my motivation in writing this book. I wanted to write a book really to encourage my students primarily, but just disciples in general, to learn how to think more biblically and to learn how to think more critically. What would you add to that?
Yeah, I would agree with everything you said for sure. I'll take a bit of a story approach as to why I think this book is important. I want you to say that I want you to imagine that you're holding a globe and it's the world in the year 1929. Okay, so you give it a spin and your finger hits Germany, 1921 in Germany. Now, in Germany, a man in his early 30s is delivering a passionate speech, and here's what he says. For us, there are only two possibilities. Either we remain German or we come under the thumb of the Jews. Okay, spin the globe again, and your finger lands in Russia, and it's a man in his early 40s. He's writing down some of his thoughts, and here's what he says. Whereas private property and capital inevitably disunite people, foment national strife, intensify national oppression, collective property and labor just as inevitably unite people, strike at the root of national strife, and abolish national oppression. Okay? Give the globe another spin, and your finger moves past the Pacific. You land in New York City. New York City, a woman in her 40s, writes these words that she will later deliver as a speech. Physical fitness being the first great requirement for parenthood, the young married woman cannot be too selfish regarding her own health. She must guard it jealously, and she is always justified in refusing to sacrifice this health for sentimental reasons. It is her own most precious treasure as well as that of the whole race. That was this woman's solution to, quote, put us on the surest and straightest road to radiant racial health. She was very, she was very passionate about having a healthy race, and this was all part of that. Okay, so here's the quiz. Who's the German man, the guy who said this, everybody? Hitler. Who's the Russian guy? Stalin, the next year, he's going to be named General Secretary of the Communist Party. By the way, this 1921 was Hitler's first year of the leader of the Nazi Party. Who's the woman in New York City? Margaret Sanger. Sanger was very interested in a healthy race. That's why she was so interested in eugenics. Literally means good genes. And under the eugenics program in the United States, 60,000 American women were forcibly sterilized because of their perceived unfitness. The eugenics movement later got tarnished by its association with the Nazis because they developed it as well. But Sanger would continue to work toward healthy race. She would go on to found Planned Parenthood, and by which she felt that we would be able to eliminate those who presumably would not contribute to a healthy and happy race. Okay. 1921 was peace. It was the Roaring Twenties. It would not remain so. Hitler's philosophy translates into action. 6 million Jews dead. Stalin's philosophy translates into action. 20 million Russians dead. Sanger's philosophy translated into action. Since Roe v. Wade in 1973, we've been able to eliminate some 50 million of our babies. Such a true quote here. Viktor Frankl, Holocaust survivor, here's what he said. The gas chambers of Auschwitz were the ultimate consequence of the what? The theory that man is nothing but the product of heredity and environment, or as the Nazi like to say, of blood and soil. He says this, I am absolutely convinced that the gas chambers of Auschwitz, Treblinka, Metternich were ultimately prepared not in some ministry or other in Berlin, but rather at the desks and lecture halls of nihilistic scientists and philosophers. So, just as Romans 12 tells us we overcome evil with good, just as we overcome evil with good, we also fight destructive ideas with true ideas. We've got to love God with our minds. If we're going to be disciples of Jesus living in Babylon, we must get serious about discipleship of the mind.
Yeah, and one of the key ideas, I guess, that motivates the book, as Daniel just made reference to, is this command that Jesus highlights when he's asked, what is the greatest commandment? And he says, the greatest commandment is what? Love God, right? But love God totally, completely, with your entire being, with your heart, soul, mind, strength. So what does it mean for us as disciples to love God with our minds? What does that look like in practice? That's really what we're trying to answer in the book. is how do we go about this as disciples? God made us in such a way as to be thinking beings, as to be reasonable beings. He made us with minds, and we glorify God with our minds when we love God with our minds. So how do we do that? How do we do that? And so that's, again, that's the thrust of the book, the focus of the book. And what we wanted to do was just unpack a couple kind of key ideas from the book. And we'd love, I'll speak for myself. I love interruption. I love questions. I love interjections. So at any point, if you need us to elaborate or stop or answer a question, by all means, please interrupt us. But one of the things that we focus on in the book is the question of how should a Christian, how should a disciple be thinking about the world? How should a disciple be thinking about the world in which she lives? So it's the bigger question is this. So as Christians, we live in the tension of being in the world, but not of the world, right? We feel that tension. And we've, even this week, we've had opportunity to talk about that, right? As we're reflecting on Daniel, we're reflecting on faith in Babylon. Really, the tension that we feel is, as followers of Jesus, as followers of a different Lord living in this world, how do we navigate the inevitable conflict that we will encounter? I had a professor in grad school, my Revelation professor, and he defined conflict this way, that conflict is whenever two things, two people, or two ideas are trying to occupy the same space at the same time. A car accident is a conflict, because two cars are trying to occupy the same space at the same time. Living as a Christian in this world, we will inevitably come into conflict with the world. Because, of course, we declare that Jesus is Lord, and the world does not declare that Jesus is Lord. It will bring us into tension. It will bring us into conflict. So as a disciple who wants to love God with our minds, how should we then think about the world in which we live? How do we learn to navigate that tension, to be sober-minded, to think biblically about the world? And so what I've put up here on the screen is kind of a matrix of all the different options and possibilities that are available to us. These are all the different options that Christians through the years have chosen when it comes to how they think and how they act towards the world. Okay? So on the x-axis, we have the in the world axis. On the y-axis, we have not of the world. And there's four basic attitudes. On the far right, you have an attitude of accommodation, an attitude that looks at the world and says, I want to blend in. I think as a Christian, I should try to blend in and accommodate the world to the best of my ability, to the best that I can. So I'm going to think like the world, talk like the world, act like the world. I'm going to accommodate the way that the world thinks becomes similar to the way that I think. That's what we call accommodation. On the far left hand, also in the world, it's a disposition that's very much in the world. But on the opposite end of that, you have hostility. Hostility says, yep, we're in the world, but guess what? We're going to go into the world with fists up, looking for a fight every chance we get. So it's no matter what the world says, no matter what the world believes, it's an attitude that says, we're going to fight you. We're going to be hostile. We're going to fight this culture war over every square inch of the territory. Okay? That's hostility. Now, on the y-axis, you have two different versions of isolation. You have two different versions of isolation. On the top, you have what I call anti-culture isolation. This would be the Amish. So an isolationist mindset would simply say this, you know what? The world is a mess. The world is Babylon. The world has a different allegiance, an idolatrous allegiance that as a Christian, I ought not have anything to do with. And so the isolationist perspective says, we're going to retreat from the world. We're going to retreat from the culture and maybe set up an alternative community altogether, removed from the surrounding culture. That's the anti-culture mindset. And again, good example of this would be like the Amish, okay? is a really good example of this. On the other end of the spectrum, also an isolationist perspective, but on the other end of the spectrum, you have what I call the counterculture isolation. So this is sort of the church as a colony within the broader world, or the church is its own neighborhood, so to speak. So whatever the world has, we sort of take those things that the world has, we integrate them and baptize them and create our own Christian alternative. So the world has, I'm a 90s kid, all right? So ska music, punk ska music was really big in the 90s, okay? And so when I was in college, there were like a million, seemed like there were a million Christian ska bands that all of a sudden became popular. And almost as soon as they became popular, they became really cringy and unpopular, okay? Although I've been told that some people still love them today. Don't know why. But this is what the counterculture looks like. This is what the counterculture looks like. We're going to set up sort of the Christian alternative. Now, most of the time, Christians live kind of between these different perspectives. Okay? We're not totally accommodationist. We're not totally counterculture. A lot of like evangelism is the balanced perspective between accommodation and the counterculture. That's what evangelism. So you go overseas, you take the gospel overseas, you go to a place like Japan. Well, one of the things that you have to do, right, William, you have to learn the language in a culture where you don't know their cultural language or their literal language. Like the missionary, the evangelist, has to learn some measure of accommodation. But also, in order to be an effective evangelist, the missionary has to be separate and distinct. So the missionary or the evangelist has to offer an alternative. So the evangelist sort of lives at the intersection of accommodation and the counterculture. Now, activism over here, the activist lives at the intersection of hostility and counterculture. So we see things happening in our society that are wrong, that are corrupt, that are evil, right? And we want to change that. And so what do? We march. We protest. Because we want to bring about that change. We want to bring about that alternative. So the activist lives at the intersection of hostility and the counterculture.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the podcast. Now come back next week for part two of this discussion. Now, if you haven't yet, I would encourage you to go check out our 2024 Renew.org gathering, Courageous Renewal. Chad and Daniel will be leading a breakout at this gathering on the book, The Disciple's Mind. You won't want to miss out. I hope to see you there.